From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo talks about his work as an anesthesiologist specializing in pediatrics. He treats about 1,000 children a year, including premature babies. The smallest patient he's anesthetized?
640 grams is my memory. It's 1.5 pounds. So, yeah, pretty tiny.
He's written a new memoir called Counting Backwards. And Jesmyn Ward talks about her new novel, Sing, Unburied Sing, which won a National Book Award this month. It's about a boy growing up with a black mother and a white father in rural Mississippi.
He's confronting basically the history of the South, of racist violence, of slavery, you know, of Jim Crow. But it's a very personal battle for him because of who his family members are.
That's on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Here's how my guest describes his work. He writes, I am an anesthesiologist. I erase consciousness, deny memories, steal time, immobilize the body. I alter heart rate, blood pressure, and breathing, and then I reverse these effects. I eliminate pain during a procedure, and I prevent it afterwards. I care for sick people, and I have saved lives, but it's rare that I'm the actual healer. That's from the opening of Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo's new memoir, Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. He specializes in pediatric anesthesiology and estimates he treats about 1,000 children a year, from micro-preemies to teenagers. He's dealt with benign conditions like the removal of a skin mole, as well as potentially fatal ones like clipping a cerebral artery aneurysm and heart transplants. He's also an associate professor at the Northwestern University School of Medicine. Dr. Prisbillo, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book is called Counting Backwards. So why do anesthesiologists ask patients to count backwards from 100?
You know, I'm not sure. I searched the internet and everything to try and find the answer to that. And the closest I can come to is that around the 1940s, we came up, medicines were developed to induce anesthesia that were given through veins, IV. And they were extremely quick acting. And I think sometime some anesthesiologist somewhere just wanted to see how long it would take and asked the patient to start counting backwards from 100, realizing they never made it out of the 90s before they were anesthetized. And I think that just stuck.
Why not count from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as opposed to 199, 98?
Because I think you have to think a little bit. You can slur the counting upwards, but counting backwards is a little more difficult. And I even make it a little bit more problematic and difficult for the patient because I say, okay, count backwards from 100 by sevens. They might make it to 93. They never make it to 86.
Wow, okay. But you have children who you're working with.
The children go to sleep by mask. So they're breathing, and I talk to them about my piggy gas story, and you know when we're slowly going to sleep, and in the mask usually there's some odor, some bubble gum or cherry to start with, and a little bit of laughing gas to try and take the edge off, and then we introduce the sevoflurane, the anesthetic gas. And I tell them the smell's changing, and we're taking an imaginary trip to the zoo. And my favorite animal of all time is the piggy, but piggies are a little bit stinky. And then ask them how many they count, and are they big or little, and do they have straight tails or curly tails? By the time we get to curly tails, they're fast asleep.
So you write in your book, I put people into a coma, and the medications I administer cause paralysis. I read that and I was thinking, please don't tell me that right before you put me under.
I don't. I never tell them that.
So you're putting patients in a coma? What's the difference between the anesthesia-induced coma and sleep?
We go right through the sleep patterns, and that if you were to check the electrical activity in my anesthesia, there's very, very little electrical activity. Where in sleep, you have different phases, of which includes dreaming. So while you're asleep, your brain is still functioning and you're still having dreams. In anesthesia, that doesn't happen.
So you're not having dreams, but did you say your brain isn't functioning?
Well, it's doing the basic functions from the lower parts of the brain that are giving you heart rate and blood pressure and breathing, unless I have given the paralysis. But in terms of the upper brain functions, no, you have no sensibility for anything that's going on.
So what is it that causes the paralysis, and what degree of paralysis are we talking about, and why are you even doing that?
It's a complete paralysis, and it goes way back hundreds of years ago to the poisons discovered in Central and South America, the Karari Warari, I believe it was, when it was first discovered. And for instance, if you're doing a very, very delicate procedure, the best that comes to mind right away is if a neurosurgeon is clipping a brain aneurysm, there cannot be a millimeter of movement, otherwise the outcome could be dramatically changed. So to prevent that patient moving under any circumstances, you give them a drug that paralyzes them for a period.
Do you worry that they won't come out of it?
Oh, never, never. While I can't fully explain how a lot of my anesthetics work, 40 million times a year people receive anesthetics and they wake up. It's a rare one who doesn't wake up. It's a rare one who doesn't come out of the medications that I give them.
And you also give a drug that prevents people from remembering anything that happened during the
Correct.
Anesthesia.
Correct.
So what kind of drug is that?
It's Mother's Little Helper. I think the Rolling Stones wrote the song about it. It's a Valium-like drug. But there's a little bit of a difference here, and let me pull back just a moment for you, that when I give my gas anesthetic, it's an all-in-one anesthetic. It does everything, including inducing the coma, preventing the memories, stealing time. When you're not necessarily going to give that gas anesthetic, when you want to use a different technique, then I can go to the benzodiazepines, the Valium-like drugs, and I can use that to prevent memory.
But people who take Valium for anxiety, is that killing their memory?
Well, it depends what dose they're taking. There's the one sleeping drug called Ambien that has had a lot of following in the press over the years, and it has the ability to prevent memory so that you can, the people are sleepwalking and sleep driving. So that the patient gets into an accident or gets stopped and the police are saying what's going on, and that person will never remember doing the driving, doing the sleepwalking. It just doesn't register.
I see. I remember when I had my tonsils removed, and this was a long time ago, and it was back when all children had their tonsils removed.
Yeah, we're still doing a lot of that today.
Are you? Okay. So I had ether, and yep. I still remember the smell.
Yes.
And, in fact, I really believe this. I may be wrong, but I lived in an apartment building when I was growing up. And one of the kids at the other end of the floor, after I had my tonsillectomy, that kid had their tonsillectomy. And I remember smelling the ether in the hallway. Is that even possible?
Oh, you sure did. The gases, the ether, the beauty of it is that it worked. I mean, in 1840s, they
But I mean, in
on.
The hallway of my apartment building, after the patient came home.
Absolutely. What really? Happened was the first ether that was used was what we call very soluble. It just got into every part of the body, and it took a long time for it to get out. On the other hand, the sevoflurane that I'm using today is very insoluble. It goes straight from the lungs to the brain, does its work, and so that it doesn't take long before that smell is gone. And by the time the kids leave the hospital, there's no issue. But I can understand why you have that.
Okay. So one of the developments you write about is ultrasound, which can target specific nerves. How do you use that as an anesthesiologist?
The ultrasound is like a pack of cards, the probe that you take, and you put a gelatin on the end of the probe, and then you just rub it along the skin. And it gives sound waves to give you pictures of what's beneath the skin. So you can see from the skin to the deepest of bones, and you can identify different structures within that picture. So I use it for a combination of things. I use it for identifying nerves. So for instance, if somebody's going to have a procedure around the knee, right behind the knee and a little bit above it in the back are a pair of nerves that come down, and they're easily seen on the ultrasound screen, and you can watch your needle get right up next to them and inject your local anesthetic on it, so you can have much more accuracy with the block that you're placing. But I use the ultrasound for other things too, because it's also great for seeing blood vessels. So I do a tremendous amount of cardiac anesthesia, so we're always looking for big veins to put IV catheters in, and we're also looking for the more difficult arteries, that we're trying to put a catheter in there so that we have moment-to-moment blood pressure readings, and we can also access blood for any sampling that we want to do during it.
So you specialize in pediatric anesthesiology. You estimate that you anesthetize about 1,000 children in an average year, and you also work with preemies. Premature babies, like, what's the smallest that you've had to administer anesthesia to?
640 grams is my memory. It's 1.5 pounds. The most recent was 2.5 pounds. So, yeah, we're pretty tiny.
This is like the definition of fragility. I mean, what are your concerns?
Oh, everything is so tiny.
Yeah, uh-huh.
It's just so tiny. Sometimes I'm asked, what's the difference between the pediatric care and adult care? In the pediatric care, so much of it is similar, but it's like you take a bullseye and you shrink that bullseye from the, 2.5 feet or 2 feet it is across over, and you just shrink it down to tiniest. So you have to be much, much more precise. The other thing is that the smaller the child, the less forgiving they are. You have to be very, very quick with all your responses. Otherwise, you're going to get into trouble very, very quickly.
You must have to administer a microdose.
We use the tiniest syringes. That's absolutely right. The gas, interestingly, isn't as much of a difference. The gas doesn't matter across, it does a little bit, but not a whole lot across ages and not across species either. So I can anesthetize a goldfish with my gas at about the same amount. But when you start talking about the medications that you're given by IV, it changes very much so.
Well, let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo. He's an anesthesiologist who's written a new memoir called Counting Backwards. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo. He's an anesthesiologist who's written a new memoir called Counting Backwards. He's also an associate professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University School of Medicine. So you're not supposed to eat before anesthesia. Everybody who's ever had any form of anesthesia knows that I think it's usually like midnight, the night before, is the latest. And you're supposed to have, what, like a light meal? You tell me.
The whole issue, whenever you put something in the stomach, you generate acid. And that acid, while the stomach is built to withstand it, none of the rest of the body is. So when you have something that, you know, doesn't sit well with you and you burp a little bit and you feel that burning sensation in your chest, that's the acid coming out of your stomach and up into the esophagus. Well, under anesthesia, I drop the tone of all the muscles throughout the body. So the tone keeping the volume in the stomach is dropped, and the other thing that's dropped is the action of the vocal cords. So the vocal cords will not close when something happens. So if you have something come up into your mouth, the vocal cords close right away, and they prevent anything from going from the esophagus down into the passive vocal cords down to the lungs. So that's what happens under anesthesia. So we want to have no acid in that stomach as much as possible. So that's what NPO is called, nil per os in Latin. We're not so strict as the 12 o'clock midnight, because if you're going at 2 in the afternoon, that's a long time to go without anything. And we also know that if you have clear fluids, things that you can see through that don't have any fat in them, they don't tend to produce a lot of acid. Matter of fact, they may actually clear the stomach a little bit. So 2 hours before an anesthetic, a little bit of clear fluids, 6 hours, 8 hours, nothing solid, and life will be okay.
So you write that the first time you saw a human heart, it was a religious experience. Tell us about that experience.
When the chest is opened, you know, the heart lies deep to the sternum, that hard bone, the breastbone, and when you open it up, the first thing you see is a covering, the pericardium, and the heart is deep to that, so you get a sense to it. But when that pericardium is open and you see that organ just moving, just beating so rhythmically, it's not like a lot of other parts of the body. You don't see them moving, actually. This is one that you should never see, but I did, and that's just the way it is. It was very, very moving.
Now, I saw a beating heart in a movie recently, and I have to say, I found it a little upsetting because, well, let me explain why. I didn't want to think about how hard that muscle has to work every second in order for me to stay alive.
Like, it sure does.
You kind of don't want to be thinking about that.
No, you don't want to be thinking about it, but when I see the heart, there's a very good reason, and that's because that heart isn't going to be beating much longer unless I do see it.
Mm-hmm. So you see hearts beating on the table during transplants?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The most, the emptiest feeling that you get is at the transplant time when they take the heart out and you look into that chest cavity where something should be and it isn't there. And that is just a feeling you never get over, just seeing that empty chest cavity. And then when the new heart goes in, you know, it needs a moment of reflection, you know, because somebody else gave up that heart for this person to get it. So, you know, there's two lives online minimally. So it is a very, very moving experience. It's one that never goes away.
See, you've had to calm a lot of parents who are basically handing their children over to you to be anesthetized before surgery. You were in that position of being a parent yourself when your son, at the age of 30, I think it was anesthetized before a very major procedure. What was the surgery your son was having?
He had a vascular malformation in his brain that needed to be taken out.
And so what was the experience like for you of not doing that anesthesia yourself and handing your son over to the anesthesiologist and overriding your impulse to, like, watch the anesthesiologist over his shoulder while he worked or she worked?
It was absolutely horrible because every second that you sit in that waiting room, you know, you're picturing exactly what's going on right behind the walls that you're trying to peer through, and you're trying to be the one doing the controlling. You know, the anesthesiologist has control of the body during the procedure and all the functions, and I so desperately wanted to be the person controlling all of my son's functions. So it was intensely nerve-wracking.
How come you didn't do it yourself?
It was at a different hospital. I would have done it if I could have. I would have given anything to do it. I did procedures on my wife, so you know, I would have if I could have, but he needed to go to a different hospital.
You write that you were overcome by waiting room paralysis. Describe what that is.
That's when you plunk yourself down in a chair and you're afraid to move a millimeter because you're afraid that in that time somebody's going to come in and announce something to you. And so you just sit there and you wiggle a little bit and you watch the clock. No matter, I've told tens of thousands of families, you know, don't watch the clock. It has no bearing in the operating room. It takes what it takes. The number one, two, and three goal is to get your family member, whatever, back to you in better condition than coming to me. And time is inconsequential. And I tell them all the time, and I know that. But when you're in that waiting room, it's completely different.
I think I've had that kind of waiting room paralysis, but I didn't have a name for it. Is that your expression, or does everybody use that?
That's my expression.
Yeah, that's a good one. So how did your son's procedure turn out?
It turned out well. I mean, we were very, very grateful. The silly thing about it is that at the end of the procedure, which went longer than it was anticipated, they didn't have a intensive care unit bed ready, and he spent, I think, about 2 hours in the operating room awake waiting for his room, and they actually, the anesthesiologist was a friend of mine and actually sent me a picture of Jason from the operating room with the thumbs up that everything was okay.
Your book is dedicated to your wife.
Yes.
Who you write, left me far too soon.
Mm-hmm. She had a brain aneurysm.
When did that happen?
She was pregnant with my last daughter. It was right during the pregnancy, and she wasn't supposed to survive, and miraculously, she did. She was in the single-digit survivor risk rate, and she managed to walk out of the hospital, but she had a brain injury that consumed her. And it took many years, but it did consume her, and she's the reason I turned to writing.
What's the connection between that and writing?
Well, first of all, she had a lot of mental changes, and so we were searching for years for different things and different causes and different help, and we went through dozens of psychiatrists, psychologists, and sociologists and social workers, and they couldn't help. And it came to the point where I just said to myself, you know, if they couldn't help her, they certainly weren't going to help me. So I just said, you know, people were coming up to me and saying, where are you getting the help? And I turned to writing because it was a way to try and rationalize everything that you couldn't rationalize. And so then as that progressed, a secondary benefit came out of it because I thought, sitting with my wife, which is all I wanted to do, what could I do that would be productive? And so I started writing about her, and I started thinking about writing seriously. And so then I went to get my master's degree. And I went to a college in Maryland, in Baltimore, Goucher College, fabulous place for me. And I went there writing about my wife. My first mentor, Diana Hume George, said to me, and said something, by the way, that Mary Carr, I think, said to you in an interview, that you can't write through tears. And they were absolutely right. So they asked me to write about something else, and counting backwards got its genesis.
Hmm. With your wife's brain changes, mm-hmm. was that cognition or mood, memory?
It was everything. It was mm-hmm. everything, but she was very, very unpredictable. She had a frontal lobe injury called dyssociative function disorder. And for anybody who doubts how great psychiatry is, and I'm not picking on them, but any disease process that you name, dyssociative function disorder, you know, you just don't understand it.
What does that mean?
It means pretty much she lost her soul, that given any time alone, she would do something bad. And so we had to keep a constant eye on her.
Bad to herself or to just in general?
Bad to herself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult.
How long did she live after that?
She passed away 2 years ago, so she made about 16 years.
I'm so sorry. It must have been so hard for you during that whole period, let alone
still
after
is.
It. Yeah.
Still is.
Yeah.
But, you know, you try and look at the bright side of things, and you try to go forward, and the comments that I've had about the book have all been spectacular, and they give me pause to, you know, give another day, let my world revolve one more day.
My guest is Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo, author of the new memoir, Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. We'll talk more after a break, and Jesmyn Ward will talk about her novel, Sing, Unburied Sing, which won a National Book Award this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Our Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the YMCA, a nonprofit working to fill gaps and bridge divides in 10,000 U.S. communities. Details about the impact of donations are available at ymca.net/giving, the Y for a better us. And from the Argus Fund, directed by Mark and Rachel Dibner, committed to helping NPR promote awareness and discovery of diverse new music since 2011.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo, a pediatric anesthesiologist who's written a new memoir called Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. He's also an associate professor at the Northwestern University School of Medicine. So from your perspective as an anesthesiologist, what are some of the most worrisome things happening now in healthcare and health insurance, just in terms of people getting what they need and being able to afford what they need?
Well, there's the one section about the boy with the transplant. And it's a very problematic, bothersome, very hurtful thing that you go through the point of getting a transplant to a patient, and the patient is thriving, and then for whatever reason, they stop taking the drugs. In the particular reason in the book is that the state coverage for the drug ran out. And you just think to yourself, how silly. Why should bureaucracy get in the middle of healthcare? But it did in a big way.
In this case, it was a boy who had been on Medicaid, and the Medicaid for children runs out at age 18 or 19. Do I have that right?
I have to look it up myself. I think it's on the 30th day of the month of their 19th birthday, the bill sunsets. And so that he no longer received money for his medication, and I think it was around $20 a day, he was choosing to save the money for something else and stop taking it. And 9 days later, he's back in our care.
And that cost a lot of money.
Not only does it cost a lot of money, these people kick into a non-retransplant list. Because they've caused their own issue, and there's so many people waiting for transplants before them that they don't even make it to the list again. And so he passed away.
Oh.
It was horrible.
How would you change that if you could?
You know, if the state would have had the foresight to say, spend the $20 a day and you would have stopped 50, 60, 70 days in the intensive care, you could have paid for 20 years of his medications. It's just poor hindsight.
So when you were just starting out as an anesthesiologist, were you nervous that you would do something wrong? And if so, how did you kind of mask that and present a kind of calm surface to the people who you had to calm?
The very first day of being a physician, July 1st, after receiving lectures on you better do all your medical charts or you're never going to get paid, and the sheriff will come and deliver your malpractice summons here and how to act respectfully during cardiac arrests, then they say, okay, go off, and you're on your own now. Go to your service, report to your service. And it was just by serendipity that my very first service was anesthesiology. So I walked up to the front desk. And at the front desk, the person running the schedule, the anesthesiologist in charge of running the schedule that day, said, you know, I remembered your name being on the schedule when you were a student doing the rotation here. I couldn't put the face. Now I remember who you are. Your first patient is waiting outside room 6. And so I was thrown into it deep like you could never believe. I had never set up a room before. I had never actually pushed the syringes before. I had never managed an airway before, and I never intubated on my own without somebody showing me where the vocal cords were. And there I was all by myself, and the attending anesthesiologist covering me that day just kind of stood off to the side and said, okay. And, you know, I pushed the medications in, and I put the mask on her face, and I got a seal, and I watched that chest rise, and I said, oh, boy, this is good. And then went to look for the vocal cords, and they were staring me in the face, and I put that endotracheal tube through, and it built a confidence that I kept from there on. Not that I would do it right all the time, but that I could do it. And so that was a very, very interesting first day of being a physician.
So no offense, but I think a lot of patients really do live in fear that they're going to get, like, the new doctor or the new resident, and that you're going to be a kind of practice patient and not have really experienced hands working on you.
One way to look at it is every patient is a practice patient for me because I'm always trying to get better. I'm always looking for better ways to do things, more successful ways
to
do things.
Yeah, but you're really skilled.
But yeah, I can't argue. I am. And, you know, I would like to be nice and humble on that one, but I am. But whenever anybody touches a patient in my stead, if I'm the one directing it, that's an extension of my hands, and my hands are right next to that patient, I'm never going to let them do anything dangerous. They're never going beyond my range. So anything happens with a patient because a resident of mine did something, it's my problem, and I will respond like my problem.
You said that you use anesthesia all the time, but you don't really understand how it works.
Correct.
Must be kind of odd for you to administer medications when you don't know how they work.
You know, I ask the patient to have faith in me as I have faith in my anesthetic, and it just works. Healthy patients go in, healthy patients come out. It's just my statistics, but I'm very proud of them. So it works, but I can't tell you why.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this very much.
Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo is the author of the new memoir, Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. After we take a short break, Jesmyne Ward will talk about her novel, Sing Unburied Sing, which won a National Book Award this month. It's about a boy growing up with a black mother and white father in rural Mississippi. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Herbert Simon Family Foundation, supporting NPR and member station WFYI in Indianapolis, working together to cover stories and issues that inform listeners in Indiana and beyond by providing critical information about the factors influencing education. And from Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, so shoppers can evaluate options in one place when buying home insurance. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been quite a year for author Jesmyn Ward. She received a MacArthur Fellowship, and this month her novel Sing, Unburied Sing won the National Book Award for Fiction. Her previous novel, Salvage the Bones, also won that award. Sing, Unburied Sing tells the story of Jojo, a mixed-race 13-year-old boy. He lives with his black grandparents. His grandmother is dying from cancer. His drug-addicted mother, Leonie, is unreliable. She's self-medicating her grief from the covered-up murder of her brother when they were in high school. Jojo's white father, who was never much of a presence in Jojo's life, is doing time for drugs at the state penitentiary, the infamous Parchman Farm. Helping bolster Jojo through these trying circumstances is the unfaltering love between him and his grandfather and his toddler sister, Kayla. Ward's characters live in the fictional rural town of Bois Sauvage on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Ward based it on the town she grew up in and lives in today, called Delisle. Jesmyn Ward has written and edited other books, including the memoir Men We Reaped, about five men from her hometown who died young, including her brother who was killed in a car crash. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
I'd like to start with a reading, if you could, maybe the beginning of the book, and maybe just set it up for us. Who's speaking here?
So the narrator here is Jojo. He is a 13-year-old mixed-race boy. He's grown up in a small town in the south, in the rural Mississippi, called Bois Sauvage. And the novel opens on his 13th birthday. I like to think I know what death is. I like to think that it's something I could look at straight. When Pop tell me he need my help and I see that black knife slid into the belt of his pants, I follow Pop out the house. Try to keep my back straight, my shoulders even as a hanger. That's how Pop walks. I try to look like this is normal and boring so Pop'll think I've earned these 13 years, so Pop'll know I'm ready to pull what needs to be pulled, separate innards from muscle, organs from cavities. I want Pop to know I can get bloody. Today's my birthday. I grab the door so it don't slam, ease it into the jam. I don't want Ma'am or Kayla to wake up with none of us in the house. Better for them to sleep. Better for my little sister, Kayla, to sleep, because on nights when Leonie's out working, she wake up every hour, sit straight up in the bed, and scream. Better for Grandma Ma'am to sleep, because the chemo done dried her up and hollowed her out the way the sun and the air do water oaks. Pop weaves in and out of the trees, straight and slim and brown as a young pine tree. He spits in the dry red dirt, and the wind makes the trees wave. It's cold. This spring is stubborn. Most days it won't make way for warmth. The chill stays like water in a bad draining tub. I left my hoodie on the floor in Leonie's room where I sleep, and my t-shirt is thin, but I don't rub my arms. If I let the cold goad me, I know when I see the goat, I'll flinch or frown when Pop cuts the throat. And Pop, being Pop, we'll see.
That's Jesmyn Ward reading the beginning of her new novel, Sing, Unburied Sing. Jesmyn, you have three narrators in this new novel. One of them is Jojo, who we just heard from. Can you tell us a little bit more about him? I heard that part of the reason you wanted to write this book was you wanted to tell the story of a biracial boy growing up in Mississippi.
Yeah. You know, Jojo is the character that came to me first when I was casting about for novel ideas. He popped into my head, and I wondered what it would be like to write about a kid like him, a biracial kid. You know, one parent is black, the other is white. I knew, because I'm writing about him at this moment in his life when he is attempting to figure out what it means to be a man, what it means to be a black man in the South, in America, I knew that this would be a moment that had a lot of dramatic potential. And he's confronting basically the history of the South, right? You know, of racist violence, of slavery, you know, of Jim Crow. But he's it's a very personal battle for him because of who his family members are. And I just thought that he, as a character, that, you know, that he would be a very rich character to write about.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of his family, his father, Michael, is white, and he's in prison for drug charges. And his mother, Leonie, is black, and she's one of the other narrators of the book. And you've written her into a pretty bad place. I mean, she's addicted to drugs. She's doing meth and cocaine. She's neglectful of her children. And I don't think you ever spell this out, but I think the reason that she's addicted to drugs is that she's, you know, self-medicating her grief from her brother's murder. He was shot by a white man, and it was covered up as a hunting accident. To make things more complicated for her, the father of her kids is cousin of the person that killed her brother, and his father was an ex-sheriff who helped cover it up. So why did you want to write her into such a hole?
Bois Sauvage, right, so the fictional town that I write about, is actually, I guess, a fictional twin of my hometown, mm-hmm. DeLille, Mississippi. I feel like in every book that I commit to telling the truth about the place that I live in and also about the kind of people who live in my community, there are a lot of people in my community who struggle with addiction. Mm-hmm. Back in the 80s and the 90s, it was basically a crack epidemic in my town. But now, I'd say in the past 5 years, that crack epidemic has transformed into a meth epidemic. And I think that I connected Michael to Leonie's brother's killers because I feel that often racist violence in the South is intimate. Mm-hmm. You know, it's in some ways it reminds me of what I know about domestic violence. Like, these crimes seem to be very intimate crimes. They happened between people who know each other, you know, who live around each other, who share community sometimes. And so I think I wanted Leonie's situation to reflect that. But I think you're totally right about the wound that she's carrying with her, the wound of her grief and the loss of her brother. And I think that does motivate a lot of her struggles with addiction.
You know, you have actual ghosts in your novel. You have two ghosts. There's one who's Richie, who was a 13-year-old boy who JoJo's grandfather, Pop, met at Parchman Farm, the Mississippi State Penitentiary, when Pop was, you know, pretty much kidnapped and forced to work there. And then there's also Leonie. Whenever she gets high, she sees her brother's ghost given. Why did you decide to have actual ghosts haunt the work?
I knew that Leonie would see a phantom of her brother from the very beginning of the rough draft, right? But I wasn't convinced that he was an actual ghost. I thought, well, maybe he's just a figment of her imagination. Maybe he's just the embodiment of her grief and her guilt that comes alive whenever she uses drugs, whenever she's high. And I thought this until I was doing research about Parchman Prison in order to write about it. And I was reading a book called Worse Than Slavery by David Ochinsky. And in that book, I read that there were boys as young as 12 and 13, young black boys, who were charged with small crimes and then sent to Parchman Prison. And, you know, those children were enslaved and suffered and were tortured and sometimes died in Parchman Prison, and their suffering had been erased from history in some ways. And so I was so, like, horrified and also heartbroken when I read that I thought, okay, I have to write about a kid like this. And this child has to have agency. This child has to have voice. You know, this child has to be able to act in the present moment with JoJo, you know, with Pop, with Kayla. And the only way that I could do that was by making this character a ghost. Mm-hmm. And so then I understood that I was writing a ghost story too.
You know, a lot of your book seems to be about the personal traumas that characters are trying to cope with, but there's also trauma on a larger systemic level. these characters are burdened with the history of oppression that have shaped their lives and, you know, limited the choices available to them. And I think that Parchman Farm, the Mississippi State Penitentiary, looms large as sort of a symbol of that in your book. Is that true?
That's totally true.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Parchman Prison is the large state, Mississippi State prison. And when it was established, the people in power sort of changed the laws and criminalized really small offenses or criminalized things that, you know, weren't even really criminal acts, like loitering, right? Vagrancy, right? They also criminalized a lot of like petty thievery. And they did all of this in the hopes that they could arrest and send a lot of black men to Parchman and populate Parchman, because basically they wanted to work them, right? They wanted free labor. And that's what they did. You know, I mean, Parchman was mostly black men. They were basically enslaved again. And they worked the fields, right? So Parchman Prison was basically a big plantation in the 1930s, the 1940s. Those inmates were also, so they worked the plantation, they worked Parchman Prison, but they were also rented out to regional, like industrial barons. They were rented out to these men who used them to, you know, clear large tracts of land, to lay train tracks, right? So any jobs that, you know, these men wanted them to do, that's what they did. And so, yes, they were re-enslaved. I mean, Richie's is based on a real children who were charged with petty crimes and then sent to be slaves, right, and to die in Parchman Prison.
When you were growing up in Mississippi, did you know of Parchman Farm? Was there a presence in your life?
It sure was. I mean, I didn't know, you know, specifically like what happened. I didn't know the history of Parchman Prison, but I knew that it was a bad place that you never wanted to go. But I also knew that the danger of being sent there was like ever present for people like me, for black people, right? I remember being very, very young. And I wrote about this briefly in Memory Reaped, but I remember being 7, 8 years old and having nightmares about my uncles and my father being arrested and being sent to Parchman Prison.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger recorded with Jesmine Ward. Her latest novel is called Sing, Unburied, Sing. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger recorded with Jesmine Ward about her latest novel, Sing, Unburied, Sing, which won a National Book Award this month.
As you said, your novel is based in a fictional town called Bois Sauvage, but it's also based on the town you grew up in and live in now, DeLisle, Mississippi. Can you describe it?
So DeLisle is situated on the back of the Bay of St. Louis, right? And it's very small. I don't know the exact population count, but it can't be much more than 1,000. You know, maybe it's 1,500. Most of the black people who live in the town have lived there you know, their families have lived there for generations. And, you know, this is the case with my family. It's interesting because it's the kind of place where family and community are sort of the same thing. You know, I'm related to a lot of the Black people who live in the town. Like, if I just count my my maternal grandmother's people, so my grandmother's sisters and brothers and all their kids and then their kids and their kids, there are over 200 of us.
Wow.
That's just a fourth of my, you know, like of my family trees.
But you left the town to go to college and grad school and I think for work too. And, you know, stayed away for a while. And you've said before in earlier interviews how much you dislike the town because of the history of racism in the state and how it limits the opportunities for African Americans there. But now you've moved back. How did you come to that decision?
I did. I returned around 6 years ago. And I have mixed feelings about it. You know, on one hand, I love my town, you know, and I love the place where I'm from. And I think in part it's because of my family. I think it's because of my community. I think it's because of the beauty of that place. But, you know, it's really frustrating to live in a place where you can see that, you know, the people in power do not care about your community. They don't care about your family. They don't care about people like you. They don't invest in your neighborhoods. They don't invest in your community. You know, when I think about like just living in Mississippi and I feel like my elected representatives never represent my interests ever. It's very frustrating because I can see what happens when generations of people live in poverty. I can see what happens when generations of people like struggle to bear up under the yoke of racism, of systemic racism. I see that when so many of the people in my community are addicted to drugs, you know, when so many of the people in my community never go on to seek education beyond high school if they graduate from high school, right? When so many people in my community spend their entire lives without health insurance, without dental insurance, without mental health treatment. When so many people in my community spend their entire lives working dead-end jobs only to, you know, become senior citizens and then survive on grace, basically, and because their family members take care of them. Like, all of that is very frustrating for me. And because I have two kids now, like, I don't know if I will stay there. I don't know if I want my children, you know, to live there as teenagers. In some ways, I feel like I might be doing them a disservice.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were feeling ambivalent about raising your kids there.
Yeah, I definitely am. I felt that way when I had a daughter, but I especially feel that way now that I have a son.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you describe that a little bit?
You know, you know, my brother died when he was 19, right? He didn't even make it to 20, and he was hit by a drunk driver. And then no one was held accountable for his death. And I want my son to live. You know, I want him to live to be an adult. And not only do I want him to live, I want him to thrive. And I don't necessarily know if he will live or thrive, you know, if he spends his teenage years in Mississippi, in rural Mississippi. You know, that I don't know. You know, part of me is really thinking that it might not be possible.
You've had some success in life. You were able to, I think you were the first person in your family to go to college, is that right?
Yeah, in my immediate family.
In your immediate family, right. Mm-hmm. And then you went to grad school and you've had success as a novelist. And it feels like you have a responsibility, that you feel a responsibility to your family in Mississippi. I was wondering if that's also one of the reasons why it's hard for you to leave.
Definitely, yeah, because I do. I feel a sense of responsibility to them, right? Because I am at this point in my life where I have more resources than they have. So therefore, I feel like I should help. And so, you know, I do what I can. And it does. It makes it harder for me to leave.
So there's that, the joy of having an extended family close to you, but then there's also responsibilities that come with that.
Yeah. Definitely. Plenty of responsibilities.
Well, Jesmyn Ward, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jesmyn Ward's new novel is called Sing, Unburied, Sing. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Tomorrow on Fresh Air...
Ladies and gentlemen, the 45th and final President of the United States.
My guests will be the two stars of the Comedy Central series The President Show, Anthony Atamanik, who plays President Trump, and Peter Gross, who plays Vice President Pence. The show is like a late-night talk show hosted by the president with the vice president as his sidekick. The President Show Christmas special will be shown Thursday on Comedy Central. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Teresa Madden directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. ¶¶